Welcome to The Crucible, where the Southern African Institute of Mining and Metallurgy gives you a front row seat to conversations with specialists in the minerals and metals sector. SIAM has well over 100 years' experience in and commitment to protecting the professional standards of our industry. Join us now as we discuss the key issues and global initiatives to give you the relevant information needed to make informed decisions, to influence policy that directly affects our sector, and to help our industry grow in an uncertain future.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to SIAM's very own podcast, The Crucible. We are starting with a brand new series looking at South Africa and decarbonisation. And our very first speaker on this is Arvia Lawrence. Getting his name and surname right was quite a discussion. Sorry, our listeners missed that. We are going to look at quite a few things in this series and discussing this with Arvia as well, looking at goals of decarbonisation. Can we maybe reduce carbon? What are the technological advancements to help with that? How is government involved? What is the impact on trading, like, for example, carbon tax and supply chain adjustments? So quite a lot that we're going to discuss in this series. But before we get into the series, I met Arvia at a pyrometallurgy conference, no less, talking about decarbonisation. And Arvia was quite passionate about the subject. So Arvia, I would like you to introduce yourself to our listeners by telling them, how did you get so involved and so passionate about this topic?
Thank you for the opportunity and thank you for inviting me here. I've been working in industry for so long, and you've been working in metallurgical processes all along. And the one thing that's common between all those processes is energy. They need energy, and some of them need a lot of energy. And the energy source can be anything, from gas, coal, and electricity. And when you look at this and you tell somebody to decarbonize something, you're taking, in some cases, quite a big chunk of the energy away from you. You need to find a way to replace it. And there's some very interesting technologies. And I think the technology aspect of it, that's the portion that pulled me towards it. It's different answers for different problems. So it keeps it interesting. That's how I got into it.
Yes. Yes, definitely. I think that's one of the questions that we want to ask in this series. What technology can we deploy to assist with decarbonization rather than just transitioning away from carbon and fossil fuels? So that leads me sort of into my very first question. Does South Africa have an energy transition plan, you know, spread out over which duration? Or are we open to just considering decarbonization instead of a complete transition?
Yeah. Yeah, it's all those. You need a complete transition eventually. If you want to talk about carbon neutrality, which us as a country has announced that we are heading towards, you will do all those things. Otherwise, it won't be possible to reach. The initial stages of your decarbonization, there's quite a number of options. Many of the technologies that we currently know, we know the economics of it, we know the viability, we know the cost. Then you move into a portion of your plans that are today not so clear. A lot of these technologies are lab scale. They seem to work, but will they be able to be scaled up by the time you need it? They're not commercial yet. And then what you need to do is demonstration plants, pilot plants on your way to commercialization. And that process can take up easily 10 years, if not more. It is expensive. A lot of the investments are at this stage at risk to develop the technology. So it will be foolish to think of those technologies as something that you can build into your plan before 2030. You need to work on it. You need to work on those and do whatever you can to help develop those technologies. But they are not the heart of your first steps. They cannot be.
So I'm hearing carbon neutral. I'm hearing that takes a lot of capital. Mm-hmm. And I'm hearing it takes a lot of research and test work. Like you mentioned, going from a lab to being commercial, we're looking at 10 years, and we're already practically in 2025. So let me ask my first question. By when should South Africa be carbon neutral?
Well, we promise to be neutral by 2050. It sounds far, but that's not that far.
No, it's 25 years. Yeah, it's not at all.
I mean, if you look at it, most of the young engineers and technicians that come from university and schools today, this is going to be their career. They walk into this exciting developments that are, and everybody is in a hurry to get it done. There's so much energy in it, from policymakers to academia, everybody's involved to try and solve it. Never has there been so much energy into something like this.
So much energy in energy.
Yep, that's exactly that.
Maybe want to ask, when you mentioned capital, and I mean our young talent, they also are our capital, also part of our resources. Where is this coming from, funding something like this that requires so much capital and getting it from lab to pilot scale to commercial? Where are we getting this funding? Each to his own external investments? Where is this coming from?
That's a very good question, because if you look at the developed portion of our globe, look at how their financial situations are, the amount of funding that they can access. I mean, they are developed countries. Their GDPs are 10, 15, 20, 100 times bigger than South Africa. We've got different priorities other than just climate change and climate mitigation. A whole host of social agendas that we need to develop and grow on. And all of this takes funding. Some other regions in this world, 15 and 20 years ahead. So they can channel today some of that into this development. And you'll see it in especially Europe, USA, Canada. The governments in those areas are in it in a big way. And they're supporting industry to develop and utilize these technologies. They're coming up with innovative supporting plans, like Contract for Difference. What that means is that the real production cost of this, let's take green hydrogen, for instance, might be $6 or $7 a kilogram in that specific area. But you, it's not economic to use it at that price. So the Contract for Difference comes in, steps in, and say pay 50% of it. Now that will cost a lot of money, but that will allow technology to develop and actually become commercial. It's one way of doing it. It's not a cheap way, but it is a way to do it. And then obviously companies in themselves, if their balance sheets allows them significant investment into this development, good for them. Not everybody will be in that position.
Yeah.
If you look at the South African situation on its, I would say on an average, we are not that lucky. Most of the bigger companies, the balance sheets are not that. It's okay, but it's not to the level that you would need for this kind of development. Our government also. I mean, we've gone through a very tough time up to now, especially the last 10 years for different reasons. And so it took a toll on the government funding. We are deep in debt as a country. And then if you look at your companies as well, not all of them, they took the brunt of the last 10 years, 15 years of economic decline, and it shows in their balance sheets. And now they're standing ahead of something this big. It's going to be extremely challenging.
Now, if we look at the balance, like you said, of our GDP or growth, and we look at inflation, we look at interest rates, then yes, it's not comparable to first world countries, definitely not. And I think added to that, as you've said, I think developed countries might have the luxury on focus on, you know, only focusing on environment. South Africa, like you said, still needs to focus on social impact as well. And I think added to that, what I'm hearing is just saying, well, it could be a lack of culture, or it could be a lack of funds, but we're behind in innovation. Am I correct in saying that? In terms of decarbonization, South Africa is behind in innovation.
I wouldn't say that. I mean, some of the things that we've done as a country is quite amazing. If you look at pebble bed reactors in nuclear, guess who figured that one out?
I'm guessing us. Yeah, I'm guessing South Africa.
It's South Africa, you know. And now the pebble bed is the center technology that is forming the basis of the small nuclear reactors that everybody is seeing as the next big thing. I mean, if you compare nuclear against renewables, I mean, nuclear is something that can produce electricity 24/7. If you've got an industry that is heavy in its energy requirements, renewables are great, but it cannot keep the lights on. You'll have to add batteries, you'll have to add storage, and then the real cost of renewables come forward. If you then compare that to other technologies that can give you 24/7 power, then the real numbers come forward. So just back to the technologies, pebble bed, that's a South African thing. We had to sell it, of course, 2009, and we decided to step away from it and did not develop it any further. But there's also a normal process. If you look at many of our technology advances, another one that I can think of is in the steel environment, the manufacturing of direct reduced iron using a Midrex. Midrex and a Corex. Guess where the first setup of this kind was built? It's in Saldanha.
Wasn't it Saldanha? Exactly. Yes, also South Africa.
South Africa. Yeah. The Corex, it's a special kind of blast furnace that is down in Saldanha.
Yes.
Guess where it was developed? In Pretoria. So that's us. We've been metallurgical innovators for so long. We've been energy innovators for so long.
Born out of necessity.
Born out of necessity.
But definitely
resourceful. That's who we are. Now, if you now look at our current situation, and our situation as a country, we are still pretty much industrialized. Many of these economies has moved on. They are at the point where they could move away from industrialization. We are still pretty much in the thick of it. We cannot de-industrialize. It will kill our economy. We will lose skills. People will move away. We need industrialization. To de-industrialize South Africa now, it's too early. We're not ready for that. We need our resources. We need our coal. Dare I say that? We need our coal. We need our iron ore. We need all these minerals that we've got as a mineral-rich country. We need to exploit that to the maximum benefit of our economy, job creation and our people, including coal. We've got something like 6.7 billion tons of coal reserves known. To step away from that, it's going to be a major challenge for this country. And to remove that as an energy source, it's not that easy.
And just looking at trading, now that you've mentioned the reserves, not even looking at resources, just looking at reserves, and you tie that to current harbor capacity, which I think what we can utilize at the moment is 45 million tons. I think going up to 50 million tons of exports. I need to check my numbers. But what that means for South Africa is we are an exporting country of minerals and of concentrates. Not necessarily, correct me if I'm wrong, but we don't necessarily look at value-adding processes downstream and exporting finished products. We are more focusing on exporting minerals and concentrates. And my question is, if we look at being carbon neutral, and so much of those exports are coal, thermal coals, coking coal, what is the impact on us? What would be the impact on the books, on the wallet, where you feel it?
Oh, it's going to be devastating. You need to replace that export with something else. You know, you have to do it. I mean, if you talk about a just energy transition, this is exactly what it's about. If you export your resources is one thing, it's a good income. But the real job creation, industrialization, comes with developing the downstream from that. Some of the ideas that people are throwing around saying, if you look at South Africa, we're currently importing a lot. And that's putting our balance of payments under pressure. If you can swing that around, use what you've got in the country, make the things, not just the material, dig it out of the ground and give it away. You've got a whole value chain that has got job opportunities, skills development, all of those nice things associated
yes.
with it. And you're selling something into the international market that probably, hopefully, can help you bring your GDP into balance again.
Bringing in dollars. Yes, we are definitely a net importing country, which really hurts balance of payment. I completely agree. Mentioning that, going a little bit off topic, not just focusing on decarbonization, do you think South Africa's infrastructure at this current point in time will support value-adding processes so that we can export finished products rather than just minerals?
Mm. Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, if you look at the part of the deindustrialization that we've experienced in the last maybe almost decade, I mean, at the peak of our industrial position, we were about 24% of GDP from industry. We're now down to 12%.
Yes.
That doesn't help, of course. And a lot of that comes from electricity, and it comes from infrastructure. You cannot export your goods through your harbors. Or you have to move everything by road instead of rail. It slows you down. If you don't have electricity to run your factory, why would you buy primary products to transform into some secondary product? Your factory might not be able to run anyway because it doesn't have electricity. And you cannot deliver to your customers. So what do? You go conservative.
Yes.
Unless you have a great pot of money and you try and get your own generation going. But many of us is not in that position. And some of these industries needs vast amounts of electricity. It's unfortunately not just a simple rooftop and away you go.
Yeah, solar.
Yeah.
Yeah, installation on a factory roof.
Yeah, that's not going to work.
And I think I've read that mining uses about 30 to 40% of South Africa's electricity generation that goes directly to the minerals sector.
Mm-hmm.
So you are completely right. It's not a small amount.
It's not a small
definitely
amount.
Definitely not.
I mean, if you look at us as a country, and I'm not just talking capacity, if you talk about a grid that is in excess of 50 gigawatts, now I'm talking capacity, and you have to multiply that now by how much you actually utilize your capacity and multiply it by the hours in the day, and then you get amount of energy.
Mm.
We are not, and unfortunately a lot of that currently being produced by coal-fired power stations. You know, it's a lot of electricity, and it's got a high carbon intensity because of the coal-fired power station. But if you look at that as industry, the first priority for industry is to have affordable, available electricity. That's priority number one. To have it green, great. But it's useless if it's green and it's not available.
Yes, I concur. Yes, absolutely. And you mentioned just transition. So I want to come back to that. I've obviously read about this, I think our listeners as well, the Just Energy Transition Partnership Investment Plan. And how that possibly could unlock financial support to address this energy crisis.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that investment plan? Do you believe it will unlock potential for us? Do you think it will offer financial support?
Yes, I do. Only I do. I mean, if you look at, obviously, as part of our commitment to decarbonize, this subject usually starts with the fact that, listen, we're all going to die because the climate is going to get dangerous. We're going to overheat. We're going to wash away. It's going to be floods. It's going to be this and that and the other. And then everybody runs scared that. But the real danger in all of that is not that. It's the policies that comes as a result of that. And a lot of that policies are really, really threatening to economies. You take things like carbon border adjustments. These things are going to interfere with trade in a big way. And if you do not, these rules are already there. And they're more dangerous than the climate, that I can tell you. So you have to adapt to cope with that long before you have to cope with some kind of climate effect. If that ever happens.
Imminent threat.
Yeah. The policies is a bigger threat to life than the climate. So what we need to do is, and as we discussed already, it's quite an expensive road that we are on. And this money, this kind of funding is the kind of thing that would help us to move along down that road. The current focus, obviously, is energy. So a big portion of this funding is going to be challenged to energy. You still need to have reliable energy, as we discussed, and you have to make it green. Now, the first technology that everybody runs to is renewables. Great, they're there.
Yes.
They work. There's big supply chains in China. Everybody is ready to do renewables left, right, and center. It's a technology that you have to use because of all of that. But it doesn't give you all the energy that you would need. You would need more. So to really get to the quantity of energy that we currently use, I'm not talking about capacity now, I'm talking about the amount of energy. It's a huge investment. And it has to be firm power. We are a economy that uses a lot of energy. And not only when the sun shines and the wind blows. So it is important that it enjoys the highest position in terms of where that funding will be applied, because it will be of benefit to everybody.
I want to touch on that, maybe a little bit unfair, but let me ask it this way. The funding that we're receiving, the penalties that we will be paying, as you said, these policies are life-threatening, they do have an impact. The penalties that we're paying, the tax that we're paying, the funding that we're getting, in your opinion, your own opinion, is this going to the right segments, right industries? Is it going into the right pockets? Is this question on dangerous ground?
I think the biggest quantity, the biggest priority is energy, and that's okay. You know, it means private, public, everybody that's involved in the energy industry is going to have some benefit in one way or another in that funding. Will there be a little bit left over for a small steel company somewhere in Gauteng? I hope so. But, it's important to get to those as well. But if you look at where our carbon emissions are currently, it's in our energy sector, producing the electricity that industry needs. And this is where the carbon emissions are. If we have a certain target to reach that we promised, national determined contribution, the right places to start is to start with the big numbers.
That's a very interesting point. I didn't think of it that way. So the largest contributor at this moment, largest contributor is our energy sector. Is that what we're saying? Our coal-fired power stations.
Exactly.
Okay, all right. And that's, shall we call it low-hanging fruit?
I wouldn't say that, but...
shouldn't you say?
It's such an important sector and so big. It's going to take a lot, and it's and if you look at the JET IP, it talks about 1,500 billion rand in its totality.
Yes,
about 1,000 of that is channeled towards it, you know, towards energy. So it looks okay. It looks logical. You know, I'm not a designer of that but you know, reading through it and seeing what they're going to spend the money on, what they're aiming at, it seems logical.
That is good news. Thank you, Arvia. Staying with the, you know, with the energy sector and the focus on the energy sector and the investment flowing towards that sector, do you think there's anything else, apart from a complete transition like renewables or nuclear, do you think there's any other alternatives that we can deploy now to achieve targets? Anything, might be in lab phase, might be pilot scale phase, anything that's in the news right now that we could possibly deploy?
Yeah, moving away from from energy for the minute, if you look at processes, metallurgical processes, for instance, in our manufacturing environment, I mean, we've got these resources. We've got a lot of smelters in the country. We're making steel. We're making chrome. We're making manganese, platinum. There's so many industries. And these things use a lot of energy, and they use a lot of carbon. There is carbon required not only for the energy portion of it, but also the metallurgical reaction that needs to take place. If you look at iron, I mean, iron starts as an oxide. Very happy the way it is. You dig it out of the ground in that way, and it formed in that way billions of years ago for very good reasons. Very happy the way it is. And it will takes a lot of energy to transform that back to into iron. A part of that energy is in the reaction itself, to remove the oxygen from the mineral to get to the bare metal again.
Our first law, the Boudoir reaction,
amongst others. That one is also
based
involved.
On carbon.
One is also there. Yeah. So a part of the carbon is just needed for that. And if you look at these hard to abate sectors, this is exactly what they're battling with, is to get rid of that portion. You can do a lot about your electrical energy and cleaning that up, but in your metallurgical process, you're still stuck. So what process are you going to run there?
Just simple science.
So if you look at the steel environment, I mean, what we're currently doing as a country and also as a world, we sort of a kind of micro version of what's happening globally. In our country, we produce about 60 or 70% of our steel using a blast furnace and above. A lot of carbon going in there. And it's a very efficient metallurgical, very efficient process, but it uses carbon. Very hard to beat it in terms of how efficient it is. Remember, that process has been running now for 150 years or so. There's a lot of thinking went into it.
Wasn't that invented, you know, in the Iron Ages? Isn't that invention older than 150 years?
Yes. Probably. I was not around to see it, but probably. And you know, so it's a very efficient process in the way it uses energy. You want to beat it with something new. Now, the most obvious that we know today is an arc furnace. And everybody wants to melt their arc furnaces using scrap. Where are you going to get all the scrap? Where are you going to get the electricity? You need to think about this.
Yes.
But it is a way. I mean, if you look at decarbonization, its first attempt is to electrify. So you're basically taking a blast furnace and you're making it electric. Electric arc furnace, then, to be fair to the conversion, it's not only just taking a blast furnace down and putting an arc furnace up. It's also the DRI facility to make the direct reduced iron.
Direct reduction.
Exactly. Yeah. So you're still using your iron ore. You're still capable of taking primary material, iron ore, into steel. That's the primary steelmaking process. You either do it through a blast furnace or you do it through a DRI EAF plant. And you need to be careful about the electricity in that EAF plant. It cannot be this high intensity that we currently have. You need to think about that. You lose a lot of your opportunity competing against regions in the world where their carbon intensity is less than half the intensity that we've got in this country. Although you're putting in the best available technology, which is an arc furnace and the DRI for decarbonization, you're still not going to get there, completely get there, because of your electricity.
Yes.
All right.
Yes.
So then, and don't
I'm
throw
also
away
thinking,
the.
Don't
throw away the blast furnace. I mean, the blast furnace, is, like I said, is a very efficient piece of kit.
It's efficient, yes.
And,
so you're not going to reach the efficiency, and your electricity consumption is going up.
Exactly.
We're already looking at an energy gap ballooning to 5 gigawatt in 2030. So it's just adding. It's adding.
What's interesting about the blast furnace at this point, you can use hydrogen in it. You can use carbon capture and use and carbon capture and sequestration to bring the effect of carbon intensity of that technology down. And ultimately, because it's such an efficient piece of kit, if you can add those to it to bring its carbon intensity down further, it's going to be a tough technology to beat, even with an arc furnace and a DRI. Most people think you shut down a blast furnace and it's just an arc furnace you put up. That's not it. You have to build a whole new DRI facility as well. Then you
capital intensive, footprint intensive, not as efficient. Yes.
Yes.
If we talk about, I want to put it next to each other. If we talk about carbon neutrality and carbon efficiency, like you said, carbon capturing, just being more carbon efficient, would you think there is a gap globally in the world for third world countries relying on fossil fuel to get that exemption, to move away from carbon neutrality and look more at carbon efficiency? Hoping our environmentalist won't kill me now, but it's a question that I've been thinking about.
I think you have to be open to that, because if you look at, like I said, I mean, these policies are dangerous. They're going to kill more people than the environment. If you look at the transition pathway, this can be a way to allow this transition without. Having so many people that quickly, that early, in peril, and transition
yes.
your industry, give yourself time to do the investments, do the technology development,
and the research, the innovation,
yeah. and transition yeah. your economy. And I mean, just to stop today a blast furnace and put on an arc furnace tomorrow, if you now refer to steel making or any of our other industries that are so important to us in South Africa. You're going to touch a lot of people very quickly.
Yes.
Very
social
quickly.
Social impact is going to be big.
We saw that in Komatipoort when they shut down the first one of the first coal-fired power stations. It was at the end of its life. It was time to go. Not economical. I don't know all the numbers about it, but I mean, in the end, you had 1,000-plus people working there, and you replaced it with a couple of solar panels. You know, so how many people do you employ with solar? What happens to that community? If you do this too fast, it's really dangerous. It's really dangerous for people, much more than the climate.
Yes.
And these alternatives like carbon capture into fuels or into chemicals or carbon capture and sequestration – is a way to use what you currently have, but do it so more environmentally and climate friendly.
Yeah, do it better.
Yeah.
Yeah. So maybe coming to our last question, if we look at, in my mind, the three biggest role players in the minerals industry, looking at government, looking at ourselves, you and me, mm-hmm. here in this podcast today, our listeners, and looking at our private sector, what do you think are the main contributing roles they can play, either towards carbon efficiency, eventually going to carbon neutrality? What can the government do? What can we do? What can the private sector do?
Mm. Yeah, the private sector needs to be responsible in terms of their transition. it's almost automatically so. As the private sector, you have a business to run. You cannot get yourself, you've got shareholders, you've got employees, you've got stakeholders, you've got customers. You're serving an economy. You're serving a country. You've got a responsibility towards all of those people and doing this transition responsibly, not doing it too fast, not jumping into technology that is not proven. Have to do it. You have to survive this, right? And while you're in this transition, what you need from your government is to protect you. While you're transitioning, the guys just next door to you doesn't care. They're still carrying on with the old, they're not investing anything. They're running their old processes inefficiently. They don't care. You investing, your costs are typically going to go up, but theirs are not.
That's a huge impact on competition, right?
Yes. Then they walk into your area at the old prices, and in if your market is not demanding that specific sustainability chop on it, they're gonna steal your market. They're going to take you out of business while you're doing this transition. You need your government to protect you against that. And this is typically why CBAM is in Europe, why Canada and USA and Japan is considering the same kind of legislation. That's one way of protection. The other way is obviously all these, like I mentioned, contract for difference, or the Americans has got a very interesting legislation called Inflation Reduction Act, very powerful. They don't even pay carbon tax, but they've got this act to a system with carbon capture, a system with development of hydrogen, a green hydrogen specifically. They are in a position to develop these technologies economically because of the support of their governments. Mm-hmm. Long before anybody else gets there.
Especially South Africa.
And especially if you have if we talk about hydrogen quickly, I mean, if you cannot electrify your processes, the next step is to move to something like, you have to do it chemically, and then everybody is hailing hydrogen as the answer. But hydrogen is also electricity, especially the green hydrogen version of it. It's also electricity.
Yes.
So we're back at electricity
we'll
again.
Have to look at that.
Yeah.
Yeah, you'll have to look at that energy balance for green hydrogen to make sense.
Yeah. While you mention that, I keep my eye a lot on these new developing technologies in the field of steelmaking, and what is interesting about them, some of them is actually a kind of electrolysis process, taking iron ore into iron, and in some form or another, some of them are aqueous, some of them are, but doesn't matter. They're trying to do it electrically. So by the time they're done and they come to the electricity consumption and you measure that, it's the same energy value than what a blast furnace uses. So they effectively reinvented the blast furnace in terms of the energy balance over that new process. And if the electricity that they are using are dirty, they still have a blast furnace. The blast furnace intensity remains. Totally new process with all that capital invested, all that research spent on, and they come to the same answer.
So really have to keep an eye on the energy balance when we do these things, especially with South Africa where we rely on fossil fuels for energy generation.
And it's going to stay around for a while. We need it, and we have it. It's the reason that our economy developed in the first place, amongst others. We cannot just park it now. We will have it for a while. What we can do is put on top of that things like carbon capture and use what we've got.
So what I'm hearing from today in closure is that there is a place to influence our government to protect us. I mean, you mentioned carbon border adjustment mechanisms. Looking at the flow of investments, where it's going, is it going to the highest numbers? I know we mentioned the energy sector. I know balance sheets are not great, but looking at how much we're investing in research and innovation. And then I think most importantly for me is looking at the value of carbon efficiency rather than trying to push carbon neutrality too fast and too far.
That's it. Yeah, I think that's a good summary. Good summary.
Thank you. And we're going to continue this discussion, Arvia. So I hope you'll continue listening, and hopefully soon Syme can put together a panel discussion on this and have all our industry experts like yourself discussing this around the table. Thank you very much for joining us today on The Crucible.
Thank you for listening. Please note that the facts and opinions expressed are those of the individual and do not reflect the position of Syme or the corporate institution.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.